Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
Tina and Ike Turner. Nutbush City Limits, from the album of the same name, released as a single in August 1973 on the United Artists record label. Tina Turner.
Well, we've done a show on Tina Turner because she was a badass.
Yep.
She's always been a badass. And all the way through music history, ever since I remember, she's been a badass. And this song was played by our sound engineer who recorded the first Whitefire stuff, Whitefire Singles, which is my first rock and roll band, and Stuart Sheffield. And Stuart used to play this before he did any mixes. He loved this song because of the snapping snare, that fuzz guitar, because it's a fierce sounding fuzz guitar. What a wonderful line, you know. And, you know, Ike Turner, arsehole. We know that, what he did to Tina, we'll find it later on. But, you know, Tina Turner, the queen of rock and roll, the lead singer of the Ike and Tina Turner Review. Before launching a successful career as a solo performer, we're going to hear about it later on, of course. And, you know, she sold out arenas, she's one of rock's biggest stars. She built a career on authenticity. Strength, perseverance, and continuous innovation.
Yeah, what a woman.
You know, a wonderful, wonderful person. And, you know, she's noted for a swagger, sensuality, powerful, gravelly vocals, and unstoppable energy.
Yep.
And, you know, I mean, even when she was in her later years, she still rocked up on stage. She had her skirts up to her bloody, it's like a belt rather than a skirt, and legs up to her bloody ears. And, you know, and she was rocking.
The way she moved, baby.
Oh, God. Oh. And, you know, and the thing is, she pulled faces. She made a right performance of it. She danced, she screamed, she, you know, but an incredible
voice.
She
loved.
Yeah, and an amazing energy. So, anyway.
Well, it's crazy, you know, because she sold, like, more than 150 million records worldwide. One of the best-selling recording artists of all time, received 12 Grammy Awards, 8 competitive awards, and a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. So this show, by the way, it's all about Tina. So
well, it's probably guessed Tina. That by now, yeah.
I've got to say, though, when we decided to do this, and I've been deep diving, really, in terms of I got completely enamoured by her, and I just ended up at night just watching interviews with her just to get to know her, because it just feels like there's so much that I didn't know. Because my relationship with artists is always in the music, and it was a real revelation to me. Mm. To as you know, with the Supertone Show, we start from the beginning. We start with the origins of the artists a lot of the time, just so that we can understand more. Because a lot of us know where they got to, but a lot of us don't know where they came from. And I think that's it. So through the show, I'm going to take you bit by bit after every song. We'll chat about the music, but I want to take you a little bit, just step by step, through some of the beginning years of Tina's life. And it starts at the very beginning. And also, as well, she was the first female black artist to be featured on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and among the 100 greatest artists of all time and 100 greatest singers of all time. I'm not really into competitions, but because I think that you all, and all these ranking things, I think you just know music if it connects with you. It's the soundtrack to your life. So let's start. I want to just take you back.
Come on, take
okay.
me back, baby.
She was born Anna May Bullock on the 26th of November in 1939 in Brownsville, Tennessee, the youngest daughter of Floyd Richard Bullock and his wife, Zelma Priscilla. As young children, Anna, Tina, and her three sisters were separated when their parents relocated to Knoxville, Tennessee, to work at a defence facility during World War II. And then Anna went to stay with her strict religious paternal grandparents, Alex and Roxanna Bullock, who were deacon and deaconess at the Woodlawn Missionary Baptist Church.
Blimey.
This is just the beginning. When she was 11, her mother, Zelma, ran off without warning to escape her abusive relationship with Floyd, and she relocated to St. Louis in 1950. And 2 years later, her father married another woman and moved to Detroit. So the three girls were sent to live with their maternal grandmother, Georgiana Curry, in Brownsville, Tennessee. And she stated in her autobiography, I, Tina, that she felt her parents didn't love her and that she wasn't wanted.
When I was a little girl, I had a brag doll. Only doll I've ever owned. Just the way I love that rag doll. But only now my love has grown. And it gets stronger in every way. And it gets deeper, let me say.
reverb. That's what we need on that track. Ike and Tina Turner, River Deep Mountain High, released in the US on Phyllis Records as the title track to their 1966 studio.
Oh.
Produced, surprisingly enough, by Phil, I love reverb, turn the fucking reverb even more and have a paddy about it, Spectre. Written by Spectre, Jeff Barry and Elliot Greenwich. The single reached number 3 in the UK but bombed at home, peaking at number 88 in Billboard. Its failure in the States caused Spectre to nearly withdraw from the music business.
Mm.
Well, you would never, ever record a track like that these days. Well, you wouldn't anyway, because where's the backbeat? Where's the snare? Where's all the orchestration? It's mired in a swamp of reverb. And now, of course, topically, we have drained the swamp of reverb. And therefore, I think that was very funny, actually. And the snare drum now is the king. You know, the kick drum, the tight kick drum. Right? And everything really nice and clean. But there, it's mired in reverb. The rhythm section was done in two three-hour sessions with a pile, 21 studio musicians. And it wouldn't surprise me if the Wrecking Crew were on that. I actually don't know. I haven't checked it out. But what an incredible record, because it makes you feel, you know. And we've just finished today. We're very tired, actually. We've just finished our record. We've just, it's been off to mastering. John Astley, who is the king of mastering, and that's basically the final process when you've mixed a record, and it's all the tracks are at the right volume and the tone and everything, and everything's there. You send it off to mastering, and what John does is put it all together. Like, it's like baking a cake, and he makes the cake consistent across all the tracks, because each session that you do, and each mix that you do, is slightly different, because your ears are different on a different day and the song's different and stuff. And he puts it all together and makes it sound cool.
I love John Astley, I've just got to say. I love you, by the way, because I can't believe what we just went through.
Well, he is one of the greatest master engineers.
And I love this man.
He is one of the greatest master engineers, certainly in the UK, you know, if not the world. We just love him. Anyway, this is the point.
Stop.
But, this, you would never do it.
No.
Because it's just swamped. But it's beautiful. It's a magnificent record.
Well, they were saying that in today's terms, like, it cost $22,000 way back then. It would be $198,000 last year. 21, to record that song.
No.
Yeah. I mean, you just, it's phenomenal, really. Brian Wilson was there at the recording, Dennis Hopper, Mick Jagger. And do you know, you remember we saw that documentary about Rodney Bigenheimer? He was like that iconic from that Los Angeles radio station, K-Rock. He was there.
Yeah.
So in those days, people used to hang out at the studios because it was a scene thing. And the arranger was Jack Nitzsche. And he said that Phil Spector would always have the writers come over to his place. And without him in the room, that song wouldn't have been the way it was, because he knew exactly what he wanted.
Mm.
So it's phenomenal. And I just, what can you say?
Well, you can't really say very much. I mean, this was early on in the days of Tina's career, you know?
Yeah.
And, but the vocal, so powerful. And
she is amazing.
The thing that is incredible is the fact, again, everybody talks about vocals being loud and stuff, but there, she's just sat on this swamp of reverb, and it's still beautiful. Her voice really punches through, and very clear, and very in time, considering.
Yeah. It's crazy, isn't it? Well, do you know how he found out about them? Because Phil Spector had seen the Ike and Tina Turner review when they were performing on the Sunset Strip, and he invited them to appear on the big TNT show.
Mm.
And he was really impressed with her voice and wanted her to work with the Wrecking Crew and his wall of sound production technique.
Ah.
Yeah, get in there. So much so, though, that he rocked up to the house and he struck a deal with Ike because he wanted to produce Tina. But Ike agreed. But he wanted the recordings, listen to this, to be credited to both Ike and Tina. And at the time, they were signed to Lorna Records, which was a subsidiary of Warner Brothers. And Phil Spector negotiated a deal. He offered about $20,000, which would be about $180,000 last year, and to get them out of their contract. And then they signed to his label, Phil's Records.
Every now and then, I think you might like to hear something from us. Nice and easy. But there's just one thing, you see. We never, ever do nothing nice and easy. We always do it nice and rough. But we're going to take the beginning of this song and do it easy. But then we're going to do the finish rough. It's the way we do Proud Mary. Rolling, rolling, rolling on the river. Listen to the story now. Left a good job in the city, working for the man every night and day. And I never lost one minute of sleep, and I was worrying about the way the things might have been. Big wheel keep on turning, ooh, the Proud Mary keep on burning. And we're rolling,
rolling,
rolling on the river. Cleaned a lot of plates in Memphis,
and I
pumped a lot of tang down in New Orleans. But I never saw the good side of the city until I hitched a ride on the riverboat queen.
Know that
big wheel keep on turning, oh, the Proud Mary keep on burning.
Rolling,
rolling on a river.
Rolling on the river.
River. Rolling,
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 rolling on a river.
Rolling on the river.
Tina Turner with Ike, Proud Mary, released in January 1971 as the second single from their 1970 album, Working Together. You can, you, I can I feel like I'm dancing on stage and I've got legs like hers and I'm dancing, you know what I mean? Because you see her, you feel her, you just know what she's doing. It's just amazing.
It's a very sort of R&B review song, isn't it?
You know,
where they do that and then they go up and everybody's going mad and all that stuff. The track, of course, was written by John Fogerty from Creedence, Clearwater Revival. And I love the original and, I'm not a great fan of cover versions. There's very, very few cover versions that I really, really like. She does a great job of this in terms of the vocal, I think. I think the Brent Mayer, the engineer, should actually be taken out and actually spanked on his body because there's some popping. If you listen to the beginning of that, some popping on the vocal. You know, so
it's when you're at the mic and you kind of say the letter P or something, and it has to get. Listen to this. This is a pop. That's a pop.
That's what it does. It's quite. Can you hear it? Distinctive. So there we are. So I think he let that one through. Ike Turner. They were probably all spaced out on some substances or something. But anyway, it's a great performance, which is the most important thing. And the version, this particular version, was rearranged by Ike Turner and Soko Richardson. Who worked with John Mayall, the Blues Breakers, and Albert Collins. And, of course, this song, as I've said, becomes a staple, or became a staple of their live review shows.
But, you know, it's one of those songs that I actually know the words to.
Yeah.
It's an odd thing, because I'm not really... Even though I love writing lyrics, sometimes, I mean, I'm really bad at, like, thinking I know what the lyrics are, and I've for years and years, like I think lots of people sing the wrong lyrics.
Well, Fogerty is a master of the lyric. He's a master of great tunes, you know, because he was doing something very different.
Yeah,
and he created this new style with Click Creedence. So anyway, we're talking about Ike tonight. Tina.
Do you remember that time as well when I jokingly said to you, you know, we were doing a Bob Marley, and I said I shot the sheriff, but I didn't shoot him up a tree, and you would not believe me that I did that on purpose.
No.
Because it sounds like, but I didn't shoot him up a tree, I suppose. Anyway, so this song peaked at number 4 on the Billboard Hot 100 charts and won a Grammy Award for Best R&B Vocal Performance by a group in 1972. I mean, so, God, this is so intense. You just will not believe the story of her life. And Tina's like... I'm going to take you to part 3 of this little story. Well, it's a huge story, actually. I'm trying to pricey it down. So Ike Turner worked as a talent scout and a session musician for Sun Records, Modern Records and RPM Records, and also had a band called the Kings of Rhythm.
Mm.
So Ike moved from Clarksdale, Mississippi, to St. Louis, Illinois, and his band became very popular on the club scene. And Tina started going to the Manhattan Club on a predominantly African-American nightclub night when she moved to St. Louis. And that's when she first saw Ike play. And she tried to convince him to let her perform on stage with him. But he was having none of it. He didn't believe her. And the breakthrough came. Her sister, Aline, her boyfriend, Eugene Washington, happened to be the drummer in Ike's band. And one night, this is the moment of where you get goosebumps. One night, Ike was playing B.B. King's You Know I Love You on the organ. And Eugene gave Tina the mic and she started singing. And Ike couldn't believe what he heard because she's got this amazing voice and this tiny little lady. And he asked her if she knew any more songs and they sang through the night. And by the end of the night, she joined the Kings of Rhythm.
Amazing.
I know, and guess what? She was still in high school.
No.
Yeah. She was that young. Like she had to she could only perform on weekends. So they had a load of different singers apparently, but then she started dating the sax player in the band called Raymond Hill, and she had her first son Craig at 18 years old.
Thank you.
Tina Turner, A Whole Lot of Love, from her second studio album, Acid Queen, released in August 1975 on the EMI record label in the UK, and United Artists in the USA. Now, this is A Whole Lot of Love. It's
yeah,
Led Zeppelin.
I know.
Which is probably one of my favourite bands of all time, and certainly in the top three. Jimmy Page is a master. The band themselves, masterful. The arrangement's masterful. The song's great. This is one of my holy grails. But I've got to say that she does a great job of this. She really does. She's down and dirty, and she really is very saucy. Saucy on it.
Saucy
and,
Tina.
And the thing is with this, it's only an American band that could do this because of the groove, the way it actually grooves and holds together and all that. And the arrangement and everything. It is a masterpiece in groove and funk groove. And, you know, a voice is but it always sounds like Tina Turner. And I was reading something the other day, and they were saying, you know, this guy went in the studio, and he was a recording engineer, and he put the faders up, and he goes, oh, fuck, it's Tina Turner on the mic, because it just sounds like Tina Turner. She is Tina Turner, and she just does the Tina Turner thing, and she's amazing, you know? So, and of course, the thing is, Top of the Pops did you know, it was a theme tune, Top of the Pops, for his CCS, which was a session band put together by Mickey Mouse. But this is just a remarkably good version, probably the only version I'd ever listen to again after Led Zeppelin.
I've got to say, though, I love this woman. I just love her. And as a woman, and it's not very often I go down this kind of feminist route because I don't think in terms of that, but I do know that she had a really tough life. And we do. Sometimes I just kind of drift through things and don't realise why these things happen to me. Do you understand that?
Yeah.
It's not like I don't have like a victim thing and it's not commenting on anybody else. I'm just talking about myself, which I'm free and able to do. I found just listening to her and you know when you hold your tongue, you know when you're going to go and do your thing. It's like she worked all her life, you know, and she just, anytime she felt bad, she was still going on with the temperature of 103 because she knew that people in the audience were there. And she wanted to make sure that when they left, they'd had a good time.
But that's it. That's being a performer.
Exactly.
And this is the thing, I've got to say, artists. That's one of the first things I was ever told. So that people are paying tickets, they're paying money to come and see you live. You have to perform. That is your job. You're a performer. All right, you might be an artist, you know, in terms of your musical career. You're doing great things. David Bowie and Radiohead and Tom York and all these celebrities, you know, Brian Ferry's, all that sort of stuff from Brett Rock's music early on. And, you know, but it's the performance that is the thing that people are watching. The music is almost secondary because people listen with their eyes. And, you know, here, the great thing about Tina Turner, you listened with your eyes, you look at her and you saw her perform, and then you heard her and you think, holy mother of shit.
Yeah.
She's ripping the ass. She's ripping the world in your asshole with that song, you know? And it's true. Anyway.
Well, no, I love it, I love it, I love it. I mean, so this, it was a Tina Turner solo album, but the first single, Baby Get It On, was actually still a duet with Ike because they were still married and still musical partners at the time. So side A was full of rock covers, and I didn't know this about Tina, that she actually did a load of covers. And she did, like, Under My Thumb by the Rolling Stones as well.
Great song.
Well, yeah. And the album was inspired because she got a role in The Acid Queen, which is Ken Russell's film version of The Who's classic rock opera Tommy, which also featured Elton John, Eric Clapton, Jack Nicholson, Anne Margaret, and Roger Daltrey. Or was it Anne Margaret, I think it is.
But that was a great film, you know.
Perhaps
we need to do something on The Who, because
yeah.
I'm not a huge fan of The Who, but John Astley masters all The Who. And,
he does, doesn't he?
You feel as though we're slightly connected with The Who, and Pete Townshend nearly bought my 12-string guitar.
He nearly did.
Yeah,
that's another story.
That's another story. But anyway, but back to Tina.
So Tina, carrying on from where we left off in terms of her life journey. So when she met Ike and she got singing on the weekends with the band, and then she eventually moved into his house in East St. Louis, and he trained her up on vocals and performance. And they were like brother and sister, you know. There was no romantic relationship, but eventually it did. And I think it somehow happened, like some musician guy said he was going to go into her bedroom and she ended up seeking solace with him to try and get away from one guy, and ended up, anyway, maybe the music just brought them together, who knows? It's not my place to say. But I do know, they were talking about this is the one thing, you know, when you know someone and you're nurturing them and they're younger than you and you kind of go, this is my band and my vision. And what was interesting, and this is fate or the universe, they were scheduled to, Ike's band was scheduled to record a song he'd written called A Fool in Love, and it was for singer Art Lassiter. But the singer guy, failed to turn up, and they'd already booked the session at Technisonic Studios in St. Louis. Yeah. So Tina got to sing. She stepped in for the guy that didn't turn up. And Dave Dixon, which is he was a local DJ on KATZ, a radio station. I did that American, by the way. He heard the track and he said to Ike, you've got to send this to Juggy Murray, who was the president of Sue Records New York. As soon as he heard it, Juggy, what a name, Juggy. He offered Ike $20,000 advance, convinced him to keep Tina's vocals on the record, and suggested that he make her the star of his show. So that's when he decided to rename her Tina Turner. But her family and friends still called her Anne. So he changed her name and said, now, from now on, this is Ike Turner. You're not Anne anymore. You're going to be Tina. He then went and trademarked her name for protection, so if she ever left, he could hire another female artist who could perform under her name, Tina Turner.
Asshole.
Touch of your hand makes my pulse react. That it's only the thrill of boy meeting girl opposites attract. It's physical, only logical. You must try to ignore that it means more than. I've got cause to be. There's a name for it. There's a phrase that fits. But whatever the reason, you do it for me. Oh, what's love got to do? It's got to do with it.
You know, because I was thinking about the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz, who needed a heart. You've got AI needs a heart. And then Tina's singing about what's love got to do with it when a heart can be broken. You know, who needs a heart? Releases a single, Prophetic, on the 1st of May 1984, taken from her fifth studio album, Private Dancer. And that was released a couple of weeks later on Capitol Records. What's that song? I mean, that's iconic, that song. Everybody knows it.
Yeah. Everyone knows it. And it's the production is 80s-tastic. I've never heard such an 80s sound. That kick drum, it's just a click, and it sort of just precursors the bass. It comes, and then the bass. And so tight and so metronomic and so programmed, it's unbelievable. But a vocal, you know, it carries it through. And, you know, it was a massive hit, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what was it say? It was her first and only Billboard Hot 100 number one single. She sold over 2 million copies.
Shit, the
Get in there, girl.
And she was 44.
I know.
When she recorded that, the oldest solo female artist to top the Hot 100. And it was the second biggest single in 1984 in the United States and 17th biggest in the UK, where it peaked at number three in the UK singles chart. Unbelievable.
And three Grammys as well. I think, what did she get for it? It was like Record of the Year, Song of the Year, Best Female Pop Vocal Performance. This lady, do you know what I really like about her? She's got really great work ethic. And that's one thing when I've just sat there in awe, actually, just hanging out with her while I've watched her on the videos, you know, of her interviews.
Because you do a lot of research into these shows.
I try to get to know people.
It's an hour show, but the amount of research and stuff that goes on.
This took me hours, actually. Because there's one thing to kind of, I mean, there's so much. You kind of want to tell a story that represents her, but also is proud of her heartbeat. You don't want to dwell on all the bad stuff. At the same time,
and there was a lot of bad stuff. You
know? There was so much bad stuff.
But we don't want to talk. So we're
no.
not talking about it.
And the thing is, I got to get a sense of her heart and her care and her loyalty. You know, and why she stayed so long and she just knew.
Hmm.
I mean, and we'll talk about it a bit later on. But it's just like I just feel. I'm so glad she did these interviews because this lady inspires me as a woman too, because there are some conversations I can't have with anyone.
Mm.
And I really have benefited from just sitting there and listening and, you know, and hanging out with her. And, you know, and people like her, you know, I actually don't have any inkling to meet anyone unless there's a reason to, where we both are artists working together or the universe conspires for our paths to cross. I'm really happy to learn about people and to hang out with them in that way. But it's like anyway, I've got emotional. So let's just get back to the bit of story that I want to just tell you for this bit of the interview of the show. So you've got Ike, who created the Kings of Rhythm. They had the girl group called the Ikettes, and he ended up then being the band leader, and he stood in the background, and Tina went to the forefront. And do you know, I've never heard of this. Have you ever heard of the Chitlin Circuit?
No.
So the Chitlin Circuit, it was a collection of performance venues throughout the eastern, southern and upper Midwest areas of the USA that provided commercial and cultural acceptance for African-American musicians and comedians and also other entertainers during the era of racial segregation in the United States throughout the 1960s. So the Chitlin Circuit, you had people like Aretha, the Three Kings, Albert, Bebe and Freddie, Little Richard, Ray Charles, Ella Fitzgerald, Etta James, even the Jackson Five.
Blimey.
So this is a circuit where they knew they could gig and earn a living. So during those days of the Chitlin Circuit, Ike and Tina Turner review, they built up a reputation of one of the hottest, potentially most explosive of all R&B ensembles that even rivaled James Brown's review.
Blimey.
I mean, get in there. And so they were able as well to perform in front of desegregated audiences in the southern clubs and hotels because they always sold a load of tickets because they had a great reputation.
All about the money, baby.
All the men come in these places, and the men are all the same. You don't look at their faces, and you don't ask their names. You don't think of them as human. You don't think of them at all. You keep your mind on the money, keeping your eyes on the wall. I'm your private dancer, a dancer for money. Do what you want me to do. I'm your private dancer, a dancer for money. And any old music will do. I wanna make $1 million. I wanna live out by the sea. Have a husband and some children. Yeah, I guess I want a family. All the men come in these places, the same. You don't look at their faces, and you don't ask their name. I'm your private dancer, a dancer for months. I'll do what you want me to do. I'm your private dancer, a dancer for money, and any old music will do.
Remarkable Tina Turner, Private Dancer, released as the fifth single and title track from her fifth studio album in November 1984 on the Capitol record label, written by Mark Knopfler.
Dire Straits.
I bet that made him a bob or two. And the song was originally intended for their 1982 album, Love Over Gold, but never made it. Tina got hold of the song because her manager, Roger, knew Mark's manager, Ed.
Roger and Ed.
Yes, Roger and Ed. And they couldn't use the original recording due to legal reasons, so they got most of Dire Straits' musicians back in the studio, and Terry Williams on drums, which he was played with Dave Edmonds, Love Sculpture, Rock Park, etc. And, of course, the guitar solo could only be one man.
Of course.
Another great person that's passed away recently, Jeff Beck.
Oh.
You know, and that, it's so Jeff Beck, it's just ridiculous. It reeks of Beck with a very, very clean sound. It's beautiful. The track was produced by John Carter, who's credited at relaunching her career, but we're going to talk about that in a moment.
Do you know what? I love this show. This show is all about Tina.
Yeah. A very late great Tina, because we haven't mentioned that she's actually passed away.
No.
And I'm sure everybody in the world knows she's passed away. But
she lives on in her music.
She certainly does. She lives
such
on
an inspiration.
Yeah.
I mean, just absolutely phenomenal. And you can kind of see when you... I remember watching a concert when Beyonce was performing, and it's like when you see the very early Tina Turner, you can see the inspiration for Beyonce too, and you can see how everyone's learned from each other. And of course, it's like she said that when they opened for the Rolling Stones, Mick Jagger used to watch her from side of stage, and then he changed his dance. And
he
ended up dancing a bit like her, actually.
Everybody learns from everybody else, and that was
inspired.
The great thing in those days,
I know.
Because there wasn't any video, there wasn't any YouTube, because everybody had to go and watch gigs. They're all hanging out at the back.
Proper with, things.
You know, like with false moustaches on and hats and big dark glasses so they couldn't be seen.
Yeah.
You know? David Bowie used to do it a lot, you know? And I know the Pet Shop Boys used to do it a lot. There's a lot of people that, and a lot of plagiarisation. Well, I mean, when Jimi Hendrix played, you know, for the first time, everybody was there. Clapton, Bloody Beck, everybody. They're all with jaws dropping. Anyway, back
yeah.
to Tina.
It's incredible. So by the mid-70s, just to really close this one episode, so Ike Turner was heavily addicted to cocaine, and he got violent, and he was just... And she stayed for such a long time because she felt that... Tina felt that he'd given so much to help her career start that she felt loyal to him and she really didn't want to leave. And then it got to the point when she just thought, oh, no, I've given you everything I can now. And so she ran across a freeway with 36 cents in her pocket and a mobile gas card. Filed for a divorce and started a new life, you know, and she took on some of the debts. In fact, she gave him everything. Well, she had a couple of cars, I do believe, or something. I mean, it's really the detail. The main thing was she just said, I want my name, because she knew then she could. But she said when she left, she didn't even want to sing. She just wanted to live and be away and start. You know, it was only later on when she healed that she kind of went, yeah, this is what I do. So she started playing and she took on the debts of the tours that were cancelled. And then, this is what I love, the love story. In 1986, she met German music executive Erwin Bach, who was sent by EMI to greet her at Dusseldorf Airport. Initially friends, they began dating. And in 2013, after 27 years of romance, they married on the shores of Lake Zurich in Switzerland. She even became a Swiss citizen, actually. I think she'd had that chapter. You know, when artists move away from where they're grown, she retired. And I've watched interviews after she retired. And it's like, she said, I've done everything, but I miss home. I was never home to watch the seasons pass. And she just wanted a life where she could not have to worry about paying the bills and just live and love. And
well, she made a lot of money in her time with these great records. And, you know, and the thing is, I mean, this is the end of the show, unfortunately. We've got to go. Remember, you can catch this on vibes.starlight-campbell.com. That's where we have our podcast now. But we're finishing with my favourite track of Tina. She didn't like it, but it's my electro thing going on with the side project from Heaven 17. The wonderful, wonderful Al Green track, Let's Stay Together.
Let me say the same, baby, since we've been together, ooh, loving you forever.